Welcome to Scotch Friday and part two, the conclusion of our adult panel speaking on social justice and the power of youth with our moderator, Martin Downey.
Can those changes be made quickly, though, as they seem to be demanded? I think particularly with what Peter is referring to here in Canada, was the laws that have been written around the Indian Act have been in place for almost 200 years, if you will, and they are been unfair and unjust for that length of time. And yet, here we are today, still talking about the fact that they exist. I mean, I know that changes have occurred along the way to perhaps improve some of those things, but when you talk, Andrew, about youth making that impact and having perhaps the patience, so therefore they're the ones out there really saying, hey, we got to do it, we got to do it now, sure, but only to a point, because some of it just doesn't happen. Yet again, coming back to the question earlier about whether or not this is really a unique period in time, possibly due to the pandemic and the effect that it had on people's lives, that they've reached a crescendo of anxiety and desire and motivation to really have some impact. Can it be the youth that will keep it moving? And Rita, I think it was a point that you made previously in another conversation about getting them engaged politically. I would think that that's something that at this point in time really does call on youth in that sense. The ones who are voting age, are they the ones going to the polls on election day? What I've heard in the past, they're not. And will this change?
Well, one of the things that is jumping out at me is how youth have kind of handed over to those who have the access and the resources and the power to be able to start addressing some of these higher level issues that have been raised already. The stuff about the Constitution, about the Indian Act, about the inequality of things and the way a lot of the laws in Canada are not equal and not acted upon in an equal way. But the thing that really moves me is that youth are talking about the real granular stuff. What happens on the street? What happens to them in their daily lives? And those are some of the things that need immediate action. And I totally get it when there's talk about defunding police or completely renovating the whole idea of police action. Because when you think about what do police do, there is so little of what they are called upon for that really requires things like a drawn gun. What they really get asked to do is stuff to deal with mental illness, addictions, domestic violence, all kinds of social problems that can best be dealt with by professionals who are trained to do that, because police are not. And, you know, when you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that's the way police have functioned forever. And, you know, you think, well, most police are really great and all of that. They are not, frankly, because there's a culture particularly in an RCMP detachment where young recruits coming out of depot in Regina get sorted out and sent into various detachments, and the first thing they have to do is figure out how to fit in. And the way they fit in is they get along with what the older guys, and most of them are guys, teach them to do. And you never rat on another member. You support everybody no matter what they do. You stick up for them right or wrong. And if you don't, your career is dead and you're ostracized. And if you're different, it's going to be hell. And that's all there is to it. And we think that things are changing a lot. They're not changing much in the police world. And that's why I think there's so much anger when these things happen, when somebody asking for help with a wellness issue, a mental health issue or whatever ends up dead. That's why people get so mad. And so they should. And if that's what it takes to make the people who have the power start to do something about the injustices that are going on, then it's time that we stood up and started to do it.
You know, if I can just add, Martin, you know, I think that there's a lot of close monitoring of police. And, you know, there were times when a police officer would pick up a kid and bring him home to his parents rather than simply charge him or her, mostly him. But the police are being challenged because I think in some ways, and I say this in a very limited sense, they're not allowed to exercise their discretion on whether or not to lay charges. Everything has become criminalized. And I make that a broad statement, but the idea that a police officer hear of a problem and not address it through the criminal justice system, in other words, lay a charge and have it proceed through the criminal justice system, is now less. Police officers don't or are not given the amount of discretion they were in the past, and they are very scrutinized by the public and the media. We know of things like victim rights. This has been around for a growing issue since I can remember, since 25 years ago being called to the bar. So, you know, now we're talking about victims' rights, not just the rights of the accused. And there's a societal perception sometimes when somebody is charged that they must have been guilty. So, you know, we have to keep a very cautious approach when we want to criticize the police. I think that the criticisms that Rita have mentioned are valid. It's problematic. How do you address it? I'm not an expert on how to address it, but I just think we need to also think of the other side of it.
Well, that's a key point too, obviously, because there's a structure there that's imperative for civil order, and naturally we need people in those roles. But I think there's a chance that perhaps with this movement and the impetus that has been created by it, for a very strong, very, very deep look at just exactly what is going on here, because there has simply been one too many injustices over the last several months and recent years to not have that kind of review. And I think the bigger question under those conditions would be, and Rajiv, I'd like you to maybe comment on this if you wouldn't mind, is that feasible? Can it even be done? When the so-called defund the police takes place, what does that really mean? Can it happen?
This is something I've been wondering as well. And I've been looking to see if other jurisdictions had tried something similar. I don't like to use the term defund. I look at it more of reallocating resources. Sure. And mobilizing other professionals who might be better able to de-escalate certain situations. But that is something that I'm still a little unsure of, to be honest. I think when we look at policing today and the challenges that officers encounter, I think it's very fair to say that they are a little more complex than they used to be. In keeping with that, I think so should our response to that. And so that's why I certainly would like to see at least looking at reallocating resources elsewhere, whether it's to mental health or addictions issues.
That's I think that's kind of important to recognize that those are key thoughts. Yes, it does have to be redirected, the interest and the movement towards defunding, if you will, is really not a question of that so much. It's a matter of reallocation, and that's it. Perhaps one way in which this might reach some level of success. Andrew, I think you'd like to perhaps say something there in terms of cross-cultural analysis of such as such. Is that what I'm reading here about from you?
Yes. Rita was saying, the issues of the police and the youth. Like, for instance, in Sierra Leone, where I'm coming from, recently, some months back, there was an incident of a break in one of our state prison. Whatever happened, nobody knows. The prison was caught on fire, and the prisoners were out, you know, running for their lives. And other people are running because the prison is found within the capital city, in the center of the town. So most houses are close to the prison. And because of the outbreak of the fire, there was movement helter-skelter. And when the police were called upon to come and service the situation, you know, when they came, they started shooting. 27 people lost their life in that shooting. Why were you shooting a situation of a fire outbreak that you're supposed to come and salvage, then you're shooting at people when you're supposed to come and salvage a situation? So normally with our police officer, like Chris has said, they might know that this is right and this is wrong. But probably also their reactions are too quick to conclude. It's like you meet me on the street. You say we are looking for a missing somebody. You resemble that person. I say, I am not the person. But you say you resemble that person. Therefore, we are going to arrest you. Why can't you ask me first and know who I am before you arrest me? So maybe their reaction also is too quick to create more problems. Imagine a fire outbreak, somebody's running for his life, then you abuse the shooting that led to 27 people losing their lives. Imagine a protest of students coming to the street to ask the government that we want these facilities in our schools, we want these opportunities in our schools. Then they are being apprehended and taken to the police. Why can't they listen to you? You are saying the state is a democratic state. The state is a state where people have freedom to talk. Then when people talk, they are being arrested by the police. When people talk, they are being shot at. No, the action is too spontaneous. It's like, this is my right. I'm doing what I know is my right. Then you are shooting at me. So you prevent so many people from talking. And when most people don't talk, remember in social justice, there is always the thought of silence is violence. When people don't talk, they become violent. Because they have so much in their head, they have accumulated so much. So then once they are pushed, they can react to a violent situation. And that is exactly what is happening in the USA. Now you see people born in places, people born in cities that were not even affected by the death of George. Even the city, beyond cities where the death took place, people are born in places, people are born in hotels, business places, beyond even the city, because of what? They have accumulated so much so that nobody's listening to them. So now they resort into violence. Because probably they think with violence, they will be called back and asked and probably bring to the table and settle. So probably what is happening in the USA have a ripple effect even in Africa, because today I see people in my country wearing t-shirts written on it, Black Lives Matter. You may think the distance from USA to Sierra Leone is too far. How quick is this having a ripple effect in Africa? It's because of the social media. Because the youth are always on social media, and whatever is happening, we are getting in touch with each other. We are connected to each other. And what you feel in America is what I feel in China, is what somebody feels in Sierra Leone. If I feel that a youth is marginalized in America, the same might happen to me in China. The same might happen to somebody in Sierra Leone. And therefore, if somebody is fighting for youth not being marginalized, I have to support that person in my own little way. I cannot fight with them in America, but I can fight with them using the social media too. So therefore, our police officers, probably they are quick to come to conclusion. They are quick to use the bullet. Probably because they have access to it, instead of listening and bringing peace.
You know, Martin, just a thought crossed my mind as Andrew was talking. You know, there were police on social media that stood in support of the protesters. We saw in the media some police kneeling. A thought crossed my mind. I was thinking back to Tahrir Square in Egypt a number of years ago when people mobilized and basically their solidarity and their protest mobilized the army in support of them, such that it toppled President Hosni Mubarak. I mean, I cannot fathom what that would do if something similar like that happened in the U.S. I mean, it's almost scary and chilling. You know, we don't consider that possibility. But if you think back to your university days of political science, there would be immense resistance to any jeopardy to any governing authority in a Western society. And a Western society, I guess, always insists that if you're going to have social justice and social change, you better do it in a lawful way, protesting lawfully, and change the laws or end up pressuring enough that the laws change as opposed to any toppling of any system that's in place. The other thing, too, that crossed my mind was something Andrew said, but I'll reserve my comment for later.
You know, I just wanted to comment on this idea about the police that Carmel was talking about. I personally have a belief that the culture of policing, as it has matured over the last 100 years, starting with mostly English police officers, and then of course domesticating those and bringing in people that are all the same, mostly white, of the English background, created a culture of almost a gang of people against anyone else. I know stories of Italians sitting in bars in Hamilton, being in the window, and police officers going there in there and dragging them out because they said they were all in the mafia. And, you know, these guys were guys working in the steel mill. The problem is the type of police officers that we have today haven't been educated in cultural sensitivity, haven't been educated in mental illness sensibilities, domestic violence sensibilities, in a way that prevents them from always pulling the gun. That is the biggest problem. And, you know, I said earlier today that the justice system has weaponized them and has sent them out there, and this is the result that we're in. You know, since the first killing in Minnesota, how many more people have died on TV right now, right, that we know of? I mean, you've got at least 7 people within, 3 weeks? You know, it's still going on. And so, you know, to tell me that we should, the police are in a bad position, it's because the people that are running the police have told them what to do. They're exercising their freedom to pull out a gun and shoot an unarmed person in the back, and they can get away with it. And, you know, and there's just no reason for it.
There seems to be a need, though, to kind of temper some of that logic and theory, if you will, with the notion that, as much as what Rita had to offer earlier, that maybe it is very, very rampant throughout police forces, at least in North America, whereby this, you know, you don't cross that blue line and never cheat or talk about any of your fellow officers in order to protect your career. All that kind of sentiment does exist, I'm sure. As it appears to be, at least in the stories we hear constantly. But on the other hand, the interesting thing is, as much as we're hearing from protesters, as much as we're hearing from various movements, be it Black Lives Movement or some of the other groups that are protesting these days, we're not hearing from the police side of that engagement so much. We're not hearing someone stand up and say, wait a minute, folks. Yes, we have bad apples, if you will. We have people doing things wrong. We need to correct that. Meanwhile, you still need us. And so we're not hearing that, and I kind of wonder, how is that? Is it because they're not capable of saying those things, not capable of defending themselves in that sense? And I'm talking about cross-generalized kind of conversation.
Sure. Well, I think you know, just recently in the last 2 days, we've seen exodus of police officers resigning in Minnesota. I think some 9 or 10 officers have resigned from the force. We've had officers in New York City resign from the force. You know, whether those are the good ones or the bad ones, I don't know. You had officers resign from a particular tactical team in Buffalo, about 50 of them, because 2 of them were charged with assaulting a 75-year-old man. But that's the kind of structural change that the youth have because of what they've been protesting, have actually resulted in. And I think, you know, we need to help them articulate what is the best way to move forward so that we can have, you know, protect and serve police officers.
Here's another potentially provocative thought, though. What role have unions, particularly police unions, played in this entire event? In other words, how much control does a police union have over a police force that perhaps stymies any
Yes. That would be a good question. I've never really been involved in a union. And so, you know, but it's still creating a cluster or gang mentality. And then when one person is attacked, they all band together to say, you know, we have to protect our brothers or sisters.
Rajiv, you were nodding your head there. Did you have a thought on that? Had some experience in that? Knowledge of any of that?
Not so much experience, but I certainly agree. I have to agree that the unions have a large role to play in this. I've always heard of the Blue Brotherhood, and you know, it's more difficult than just talking about use of force. You know. Preparedness for dealing with addictions and mental health issues. It's also a culture, and it's a very, very toxic culture. And going back to what Andrew had to say, you know, coming from Sri Lanka, where there was a civil war, where things sort of started really peaking is when people felt so marginalized that they also felt they had nothing to lose. So with an ill-equipped police response, plus groups of people feeling so marginalized that they have nothing to lose based on what they did, I think is a very deadly combination.
Yeah.
Something that we need to really, really study.
Yeah. I'm going to inject one request here, folks. Apparently, we all need to speak louder, including myself. I believe the director is telling me this in my ear, so to speak. If anybody perhaps has a thought on this too, I would imagine that perhaps Peter, you've encountered conversations of this sort from various experiences that you've had within Indigenous communities across this country. That the police forces, as Rita's pointed out, particularly our federal force, the RCMP, have undoubtedly had many more interactions with Indigenous people over the years than perhaps any other city forces, for that matter, or municipal forces. Are you seeing that in itself is a real stumbling block to any kind of progress with youth and social justice?
I think maybe bring it back and to kind of where we entered this conversation is, I think they absolutely have been colonial tools of the state. There's no question about it. The Northwest Mounted Police were created to get rid of the Métis taking over Métis homelands. And as the railway went out west, they followed along and made sure it was cleared and any insurrection was dealt with. So that is in the very foundations, the very fabric of how this country was built. And I think, you know, back to your union question, I think it's a great question. I also think corporations have a large stake in this. When pipelines aren't getting built, when certain companies are economically incentivized to ensure that, you know, Aboriginal title and rights issues aren't resolved or protests are misconstrued or there's force. And I don't think there's a direct parallel line between any of these companies calling the commissioner of the RCMP and asking for action. It is endemic in the system. It's endemic in the system that pays for elections, that gets people elected, that creates the laws, that gets the public pressure, that responds to the electorate, responds to their donors, and results in swift action. And I think that's why we need the energy of youth. And it will only be the youth that's going to, because they have the most to rage against this entire machine that's been created. They have, they see their entire lives out of them. They're 20% of the population. They're taking over leadership positions. They're not stuck in all of the luggage and baggage that we all have. You know, sometimes I hark back to the Vietnam generation, the Justice generation, all the things that happened in that generation. And they all, well, they're all quite old now, but they've all had mortgages. They've all, they're unable to be on the front lines because they have to be in work on Monday and they can't resist any issues of actually fighting and changing themselves or doing what needs to be done. This generation is unencumbered by that, nor do they have the same, they're not worried about offending a multinational employer that's going to stop their one-stop career so they can make partner. And in fact, they're going to have multiple careers and they're actually going to have this part of their life as a big part of their foundation. So, and I think, again, back to the start, that's why we need youth so much. And that's why only they can do it. Because if it was left up to us, we have to go back to our cozy suburbs and get in our homes quickly so we can pay the mortgage and get to the next job or go on to the next podcast. So I think that's right. I think that's the reality that that we face.
You know, the other thing about our youth today is they're connected. They're socially connected. Mm-hmm. And the George Floyd incident recently showed how powerful that connection is, that it rippled around the world in a very short, remarkably short time span.
Well, all very good points, Peter. And I guess the question that comes to mind after that is simply, in order to keep this momentum moving forward, like with the youth at the helm, what do we do as adults? What do we do as the so-called seniors in society, so to speak, to help them? Or do we just simply get out of their way?
I think that's the first thing. I think creating space is the first thing, allowing youth to occupy that space. I think, because we can use our existing power structures, whether it's titles, whether it's things we've done, whether it's the positions that we hold today. I think those things can get in the way and interrupt youth from occupying their space. I think that we also have the opportunity to look internal and think about how we've become complacent and how we all are socially justice-minded people. But what have we done in the last 10 years to rage against all the things you've seen? From the Indigenous perspective, what's happened when you first heard the Manitoba Justice Inquiry or the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples or the Truth and Reconciliation Report or the Murder and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls Report? Mm-hmm. I think we've all become complacent by the next thing. And I'm included in that. I mean, I was certainly on the front line of some things when I was younger. As I've evolved, I think, oh, that's someone else's work today. But as a society, it only takes root if we all take control of it. So I think we have to look internally. How do we support youth, create space, use our existing power structures, certainly in positions that we hold, to help further those causes? But I think we're as allies. I think that's the best way to think of it.
But I think we can start the conversation with our young people. I mean, you know, I'd like to think that we have a little more knowledge and wisdom than the youth. And that we can be.
But there. You know what? Your parents felt that. Their parents felt that. The parents before them felt that. Go watch Leave It to Beaver and say, oh, geez, Beav, your generation's not as good as my generation. And then go watch. Every single generation is exactly the same.
Trust me, I get my share of being dismissed by my daughter. So I recognize what you're saying. But there are moments when the conversation is addressed by them to us. And I think that that's an opportunity that we cannot miss. So when the conversation is there, or the opportunity is there to have the conversation, we need to have a mindful one, and we need to be fully engaged with our youth. And I think we do have an impact. Yes, we give them space. They have the energy. But I think we cannot forget our important role in guiding them in the direction that they need.
But a conversation like this cannot go with a little touch of political insight here. So my question on that point, to further extend Peter's thoughts, is do we have the political politicians, let's say, in place that might help change things, or do we see anybody in the forefront without necessarily coming up to the ranks?
Sorry, your voice, Martin.
Sorry, do we have people coming up through the ranks in the political system in this country to potentially help affect those changes? Ones that, for instance, that the youth will get behind and be able to go to the polls and vote for. We see that coming down the pipe. But metaphorically speaking. Anybody?
Well, you know, I'll say this and I'll pause for a bit, let others get in on it. And this is not meant to be partisan whatsoever. When Justin Trudeau was elected the first time, it was going to be the last election of the first past the post system, which is a young person's issue, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. Young people were striving for a change to the political system, the same old status quo, to break it up and find a way to vote. It was one of the first things that was proved, you know, unable to get passed was, you know, proportional representation. So I think that just feeds into, I don't think there is a savior out there. I think the savior is each and every one of us. And I think it's the changing of the overall system overall that's going to hearken. So I'll pause and let other people speak.
To add to that conversation, I would just want to say, as adults, I think we have a role. And as a political maybe entity or political being, we also have a role to ensure that we help the youth. And these rules can vary. It depends on individual differences. Despite the fact of creating the space for them, we also need to keep them close. You know, if you create too much of space, they may accumulate so much so that when you want to close a space now, they have gone to higher than you. So I believe as adults, we are supposed to give the youth the support, the advice and assistance they need. You don't just need to give them all the space. You have to support them. You have to give them the advice and assistance. I also believe that in our duties and rights, we also need to be taught our responsibilities and our burden. If I have a right to eat, I should know that I have a right to help my family to clean the house, you know, to take care of my little kids. If I have the right to talk, I should know that that right should not affect somebody else. So we have to assist the youth in all of these areas, that despite the fact that you have the right to some of these things, but also be aware of your responsibilities and therefore your burdens. We also need to assist them in communication, because as Kama said, there are instances youth are very quick to react. But with adults, we can think, because always there is a proverb that says, what a young man can climb an oracle tree to see, a old man can sit down and, you know, and visit that. So I think some areas they need to be guided by people to assist them to talk. Maybe this is the issue that's affecting them, but they don't know how to channel their problem. They don't know how to say their problem, so they result in violence. So the best, we need to assist them how to channel their problems, how to channel their crisis across. I also think that despite the thought of saying they are the victims, you know, they are the cause, they are the this, they also need assistance. As Kama was saying, there's a new law or what that is protecting the right of the victim. Even if I create a problem today, I also have a right. It doesn't mean that because I'm riding a bicycle without a bell, I haven't got a right. I have a right, and therefore that right needs to be protected. It doesn't mean that if I'm walking on the street drunk, going to my house, you have to misunderstand me that I want to cause trouble. No. You have to look at psychology too. Today, the world is becoming a global village, and people have so many problems. You can see a gentleman sitting down, not talking. For you, he is planning to create a problem. You don't even know what he's going through. So if you just come and shoot at him, thinking that he's planning something bad, you are wrong. If you see somebody walking home drunk, you don't even know what led to him to get drunk. Then you just see him and shoot him at the back. You are wrong. At times, people are peaceful. You don't need to interpret their action based on their behavior. It doesn't mean that because you see me, I dance too much, meaning I'm dancing because I want to distract. No. You don't have to interpret my behavior based on my action. So I think with adults, we need to assist the youth in so many areas. We need to give them the space, yes, because they also deserve that space. But let's not give them too much space that they can accumulate so much that when once you want to create that gap, it becomes a problem.
So study on civil behavior, is that something you're saying, Andrew, perhaps is missing from the education systems around the world today, whereby we're not teaching kids enough about what it means to be responsible human beings once they get into society?
Like you said, like I could take a simple example from my country. It is only now they are introducing a civil education. You know, we never had civil education in our country. So most of the rights, they are there in the documents, but we don't even know them. So when once you don't know them and you go against them, they will tell you ignorance of the law is no excuse. But you don't know the laws. You are not taught that in school. Nobody taught you civil education. Nobody taught you the rights of your country. Nobody taught you responsibility to your country. So if you grow to a youth, you misbehave, then you are caught by the police. They say, this is a law. Then you say, I don't know. They say ignorance of the law is no excuse. So I think we have to go back to the drawing board. Probably start civil education from the primary schools, the secondary schools. So once people know that these are our rights, but to this right, we also have a responsibility. I think it will lessen the burden. Because just to say, I have a right, to every right, there is a responsibility. Yeah. You cannot just accumulate all of the right, leaving your responsibility. No, it's wrong.
But very pertinent point, Andrew. So I think we may start to wrap things up a little bit here at this point. I guess my last question would be, what do we do? Where do we go from here? What kind of direction do we see perhaps any of us participating further in that way, in terms of helping youth do what we suggest that they're doing, and hopefully they're doing it well and right, and we're going to see some significant changes? Is there anything we should be doing? What's the next steps here for any or all of us involved?
I have some thoughts on next steps. I don't know whether this works across the board, but for me, in my community, I've been very involved with the provincial and federal members of parliament and members of the legislature. Whenever I want something, whether it's money for housing or addictions treatment or transition houses or anything that I've been involved in my community, I never hesitate to go to the appropriate political person with the purse. And they know me, and they've been responsive. It's now time for me to go and talk about all these things that we've talked about here and talk about how I expect our political leaders to be taking these things seriously and starting to move forward with them. And those are the things that those of us who have any kind of political connections ought to be able to do. And the other thing is about making space, absolutely. And the other thing is to be really supportive. And when I hear people on the street or in the coffee shop or whatever saying anything negative about young people, the Black Lives Movement, anything like that, I'm going to speak up. And I'm going to support the youth that are doing all these things that have needed to be done for so long. And I'm just going to make sure that I'm one of them. And I'm going to be there.
I think that's a key change that we're seeing happening in some cases. People are freer to speak their mind in public things for some reason than they have been in the past.
Speak up, Martin.
I think that's a very key point, because people are a lot freer to speak, seem freer to speak out loud about opinions these days, much more so than ever in the past. So I think that's a good point, that we all should do that. It's, call out those injustices where and when we see them.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. You know, the other thing that I think, and I mentioned it last time, was, you know, taking some time to listen to the youth panel that you guys are going to have, and hear what they have to say, and, you know, and then hopefully maybe have an opportunity to engage with them to, you know, understand how they feel and what they think they can do. And if they ask us for advice, then we can give them some. And if they don't, then we'll just try to, you know, go along with what they're trying to do. And if we can support them in a specific way, we will. But that would be the best, in my opinion, of moving them forward and helping them move forward.
Renee, you're talking about the group that will follow this podcast sometime in the near future, of a collection of youth who will right. hopefully offer their input that way. And yes, I agree. I think that will be a key movement for us to, or a key moment for us rather, to get involved further once we see and hear what is being talked about by that select group. That,
And I'm just really interested in hearing what they say.
Of course. Of course.
Absolutely.
So, we're going to be sure to invite you all back for that conversation. I think it's perhaps time now to kind of wrap things up. And unless anyone's got anything further to add, I think we'll...
Just one small thing, yeah. Martin, if I might.
Please do. Go ahead.
I heard a lot about the fact that, or the statements that police don't know enough to handle certain situations. And I think that's clear, and you were asking about what do you think we should do or what should be done. And I think there has to be better education offered to police officers to deal with the Aboriginal youth, the problems of Aboriginal youth, the problems with mental illness, the problems with a whole variety of social issues. That's where the defund police argument should be directed towards. It's defund them militarily, perhaps, because I don't think they need the military power that they're given. And I don't know what Peter would think on that, but and direct some of that funding or a good chunk of it to constant education. You know, we teach police how to use a gun. Let's give them the same amount of effort on how not to use the gun, and other tools that they can use in understanding the society in which they police. One other comment I think about youth is, I mean, I was young once, and I remember how engaged I was, and I don't want to dismiss that part of it. But youth, I think, are not aware of the tremendous power they have to bring about social change. You know, we see it as adults when they mobilize, but I really think they take it more for granted. And we look back as adults and say, wow, they did it. They mobilized. They do it. And I think that goes to Peter's comments that, you know, we're more worried about our mortgage payments and other mundane issues. So I always try to, when I have opportunities to speak with youth, to tell them that how much potential they have to change their own lives and the lives of those around them. I think that's critical.
Peter, the last word is going to go to you here this evening, if you would.
Well, what I wanted to say was how encouraged I have been by the way the youth voice has ramped up and has been sustained. One of my worries when I left the Assembly of First Nations in 2016 was, have we as a country reached what I would call peak reconciliation? The Prime Minister in his first budget in 2015, you might recall, had $8.9 billion invested in Indigenous priorities. Every single cabinet mandate letter had the nation-to-nation relationship as his most important relationship listed in their mandate. We had all across the country, all segments of society trying to respond to the TRC calls to action. I was really worried that we reach peak reconciliation, that people were going to eventually turn their attention to something else and get frustrated. And it might have gotten a little quieter. The intensity has got a little quieter. But as youth have risen up across the country in response to the George Floyd incident, to talk about racial issues in Canada, the importance of anti-racism, all this has come back up. And I think that it shows youth today are able to sustain it in a way that my generation hasn't been able to. And I think really all the way back to the 60s generations have not been able to. And it could just be a moment in time. It's a convolutions of events. And it's really their mantle to take, and it's our mantle to support as best we can, is my view. And I'm just really encouraged by how much has happened and how much they've been able to use the new tools we have to accomplish so much. So it's just a last word of encouragement, I would say.
However, with that last word, we've got one more thought, I think, coming from Andrew at the moment to jump in, and perhaps we will end it at that point. Andrew?
What I want to conclude is what we have to do, like I just wrote in the group, is we have to revisit our laws again and the law enforcement officers, like Kama said, maybe provide them some basic education, basic training on how to handle riot situations, how to handle outbreaks, these type of things. We also have to revisit our institutions. Our institutions have a very big role to play to impact the youth. We also have to revisit our own rules as adults in the society, our own roles as community leaders. We can do our best in our small communities we find ourselves to influence the lives of so many people. And also we have to revisit our political entities and institutions. They have a very greater role to play when it comes to youth, when it comes to national wealth, national opportunities, and national challenges. We also have a lot to do on education. Education on civil rights, civil rights education, civic education. We have a lot as education institutions. Because when once we provide these basic things, when once we revisit these basic things, I think it can help a lot to combat most of the things that are happening with youth. Thank you all, and thank you for having me.
On that word, I'm going to thank all of you as well, folks, for being here this evening and for participating in this way. All valuable contributions to this conversation, which I hope we will continue effectively with the panel on youth that we will, as mentioned, will be creating in the next short little while here, for which we'll invite you back to participate in. But in that respect, I'd like to, again, just say thank you. Remember to have folks out there listening in and watching, please remember to have your say. Go to our comments section on our website at www.scotchfridays.ca. Tune in next time to our youth panel conversation on this subject. My name is Martin Downey, and I thank you for listening to this very special series. Until next Friday, goodbye and be well.
I invite you to join us next week when our youth panel speaks on the power to bring about social justice. Till then, goodbye and stay safe.